Well, it's really good to have Brother Dan Guy with us once again from Balmoral Place in Halifax, and we shortly look to him to speak to us on the subject of Gideon. And before we hand over to Darren, he's asked that we take an introductory reading from Judges. We're going to read some of Judges chapter 6. So Judges chapter 6, I'm going to start at verse 7 through to verse 32.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. Good to be with you. A strange question to sort of ask you to think about. I don't know your family situation, but imagine you have a daughter, and your daughter's not married, and she's a religious girl, she's a Christadelphian girl, and she comes home from work one day, or from wherever she's been. She says, "I've met a young man, and I'm going to marry him." And he's Gideon. Would you be pleased? I don't expect you to admit to it, but I don't think as a parent you'd be particularly pleased. Yeah, man of faith, but he was a man of war, brothers and sisters. If you read through the things that he did, I haven't got a daughter, but I don't think I'd like my son to be like Gideon. Now then, of course, he's recorded in Hebrews 11, just in passing, he was a man of faith. And one of the things that jumps out and strikes me, for example, remember, as a contrast, remember the occasion when Saul was, the very first task that King Saul was given was to destroy Agag of the Amalekites. And Saul was a big, strong man, a man of war, and he was told to destroy the king, King Agag, and not to take any spoil of the animals or the best people or whatever. And what does he do? His very first job, he fails. And no wonder the thing displeased the Lord, and God repented that he'd made him king in the first place, in a sense. Whereas, by stark contrast, brothers and sisters, with Gideon, the very first thing that is asked of Gideon is, throw down all the altars of Baal, and where are you going to start? You're going to start at nowhere does it tell us that beforehand that Gideon was experienced in warfare or battle. The very first place that you're going to start, Gideon, is your own father's house. Now, forgive me for saying this, brothers and sisters, but I think that's probably the hardest place for him to start. And yet, he does it. So when we read little words like, he did it by night, because he was fearful, I don't know what you think about fear and courage, brothers and sisters, but I once heard the definition of courage being doing something even though you fear. He was fearful, and yet he still do it, did it? Be strong and of good courage. Fear not, neither be dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee. He was fearful of that which he was asked to do, and yet he still did it. So if your daughter came home with one such as Gideon, you should be pleased. So then, Judges chapter 5, first of all, and if you'll come with me, I can't really cover the whole subject of Gideon, I don't think, in one Bible class. There's so much there. He was loved by God. If you can recall the account, he lost his family. He had 70 sons, and he lost every one of them. They all, granted, they didn't die before he died, but there would be no inheritance after Gideon. All of his 70 sons, you wouldn't expect that, would you, brothers and sisters? A man of God who had 70 sons, the different wives, none of them would continue. And yet, he gained an inheritance because of his faith, and it's something we have to bear in mind. He gained the kingdom, a place in it, surely. Anyway, Judges 5, verse 31. To show the context. So, let all thine enemies perish, O Lord, and let them that love him be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might, and the land had rest 40 years. And that's the statement that sums up what's just happened. Remember, we've got Deborah and Barak, and we've got Sisera, and Jabin, the enemies of the Lord. And Deborah says to Barak, or Barak, however we say it, go to the top of the mountain and run down and fight a battle against those 900 chariots of iron, the biggest army there was at the time. And Barak says, I'll go if you go. And he eventually goes, his faith is encouraged. Now, after those things, and those incidents are touched upon a little bit, in the account of Gideon, and also the link to the account of Gideon in other prophecies. I think prophecies concerning the time of the end. Because the things that happened in the days of Deborah, and the things that happened in the days of Gideon, are not only a looking back at faith and what faithful men and women can do, but the same circumstances that occurred to them in those days will occur in the last days, and my people shall be saved, says God. And we might go to a particular psalm that I think is pointing to the future whilst looking at the back. Anyway, so the land has had rest 40 years. Then we come to chapter 6, which we didn't read this part. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. You could almost say to you, I don't know the original Hebrew, you could almost say there's a word missing there. Surely it should say, and the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. It's shouting out at us, yeah, once again, they've gone and done their own thing. But anyway, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. God does it because of their disobedience, and there's prophecies that said that he would do this. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made the dens which are in the mountains, and caves and strongholds. And so it was, when Israel had sown, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, there's a connection, the Amalekites, of whom the king was Agag, whom Saul should have utterly destroyed when he had opportunity, because those, why? Because those people didn't just hate Israel, they wanted Israel utterly wiping off the face of the earth, and they wanted God's name wiping off the face of the earth. And we'll go possibly later to a verse which sort of sums that up, really. And so it was, when Israel had sown, they've sown their seed, whatever it took for crops, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, and the children of Israel, children of the east, and they came up against them, and they encamped against them, and destroyed the increase of the earth, till thou come unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. They utterly messed them about, and they were, we could say, they were possibly on the brink of starvation. They had everything taken from them, from this wicked people, and God made it so. Why? So that they would turn unto him. How bad is it going to be before the Lord returns, brothers and sisters? The Lord will make it happen that the circumstances which will prevail in the final days before the Lord Jesus return, they will turn unto him. We could say from Zechariah's prophecy that 2/3 of the city will die, which, according to relatively recent population statistics, 5 million people, 2/3 of which is 3 million people, must die in Israel because of the wicked, awful, terrible things that are happening to them. All part of God's plan. So what we see in the back in the book of Judges is a prophecy for the future as well. 4 verse 5, they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitudes, for both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it, and Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. And then the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. How bad is it going to be, brothers and sisters, before they call for Messiah? And they will call for Messiah. And they'll call for the one whom they pierced and mourn. And then he will come. It's a sign for the future. Perhaps if you come back with me to Leviticus, brothers, you might like to keep a marker in Judges. Leviticus 26. Leviticus chapter 20. For those who don't feel able to move backwards and forwards with the scriptures, that's fine. Don't be embarrassed about it. But Leviticus chapter 26, it would help if I was in Leviticus instead of Numbers. Anyway, Leviticus chapter 20. I thought it looked something like one of those horrible feelings. And I looked down and it said nothing of the sort. Anyway, Leviticus 26, where you probably are, and I'm still getting there, reading from verse 16, where we read, I will also do this unto you, says God. I will even appoint over you terror. We live in days where the word terrorists is part of everyday language, and it hasn't been before, particularly. But now the word is in great use, isn't it? I will even appoint over you terror, consumption, and the burning ague that shall consume the eyes and shall cause sorrow of heart, and you shall sow your seed in vain. That's what it said in the law, and that's where we're up to in the days of Gideon. You shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. And I will set my face against you, says God. That's what I'm doing. And you shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when none pursueth you. If you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins, and I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron, and your earth as brass, and your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits. And this is where we're at in the days of Gideon. They sowed their seed, the crops were either messed up or stolen, and they had nothing. Now, sorry, if you come back with me to Judges then, brothers and sisters. No, tell you what, we won't. We'll come back to that in a minute. Come with me to Deuteronomy chapter 11, before we then go back to Judges. Deuteronomy chapter 11. I'm not asking you to say it out loud, but I wonder if you know what the name Gideon means. Well, you will in a minute if you don't already, but have a think about that and see if you think, well, it's recorded in prophecy, really, in a sense. Now, Deuteronomy chapter 11, starting at the end of the chapter, because it's chapter 12, really, that we want, verse 31 of chapter 11. And you shall observe to do all the statutes and judgments which I set before you this day, chapter 12. These are the statutes and judgments which you shall observe to do in the land which the Lord God of thy fathers giveth thee to possess it. All the days that you live upon the earth, ye shall utterly destroy all the places wherein the nations which ye shall possess serve their gods, upon the high mountains, upon the hills, and upon every green tree. Ye shall overthrow their altars, and break their pillars, and burn their groves with fire. When you get into these places, this is what you want to do. And ye shall hew down the graven images of their gods, and destroy the names of them out of their place. Did you notice Gideon there? What was the first thing that Gideon was asked to do? He was told to hew down the altars in his father's house. The name Gideon means hewer, as in to cut down, H-E-W. And the Lord taught them that. You shall Gideon them. Verse 4, you shall not do so unto the Lord your God, but unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even unto his habitation shall ye seek, and thither thou shalt come. And thither ye shall bring your burnt offerings, and your sacrifices, and your tithes, and heave offerings of your land, and your vows, and your freewill offerings, and the firstlings of your herds, of your flocks. I expect you to do sacrifices. Now, a silly question. Which animal of the flocks or the herd did they have to kill for the sacrifices? Was it the thirdborn? The fifthborn? The seventhborn? It was the firstborn, wasn't it? You might wonder why I'm saying that, because this crops up. It begs the question when we look at the life of Gideon. Why did Gideon not give the firstborn? Well, I'll give you an answer when we get to it. Verse 7. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in all that you put your hand unto, ye and your households, wherein the Lord thy God hath blessed thee. Ye shall not do after the things that we do here this day, every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. When you get to your land, I expect you, I command you, to do the things that I tell you of. You will hew down all the altars of Baal and Ashtaroth. You will get rid of all the false religion. You will worship properly. You will offer the firstlings of your flocks and of your herds. Why the first thing? Because that's the best. It's the first one, as it were, that openeth the womb. It's the one which I rejoice in most. I expect the best from you. And they didn't for 40 years. So the Midianites were sent to them. Now let's go to Judges. Judges, verse chapter 6, linking what we've just said, and Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, and it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord because of the Midianites, they were put into a situation that the Lord knew, that in due course they would cry unto him, they would turn unto him, because they were desperate. That when this happened, verse 8, that the Lord sent a prophet unto the children of Israel, which said unto them, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt, and brought you forth out of the hand of bondage, and delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of all that oppressed you, and drave them out before you, and gave you unto their land. And I said unto you, I am the Lord your God. Fear not the gods of the Amorites. Remember what it said earlier about the people who came from the mountains? Well, Amorites means mountaineer. They were called mountaineers. The Amorites were known as mountaineers. And the children of Israel were so impoverished and so abused that they even tried to run and find caves to dwell in. But the Amorites were there. They had it really bad. In whose land ye dwell, but ye have not obeyed my voice. Now, the name Gideon, I imagine you can't think of other places where the name Gideon appears. Only once in the New Testament, in Hebrews 11, time would fail me to tell of Jephthah, I forget the order now, of Samson, of Gideon, of Barak, etc. Time will fail me to tell, says Paul when writing that. You'll only find the name Gideon in Judges, other than Hebrews 11, once. But you will find the name Jerubbaal, which is a surname, which is in chapter 9, and also, we won't turn to it, 1 Samuel 12. So when you come across Jerubbaal, it's Gideon. And there's a verse, which is we might come to later, where both names are used. And it reads quite strangely. It reads like there's two people, but it's not, it's the same person. Gideon, you do this. Jerubbaal, you do this. It's the same person. We need to think about that at our leisure. And the word Jerubbaal, the name or the title of Jerubbaal, means let Baal plead, or let Baal contend. This one who is Gideon means hewer down of what? The images of Baal. So his title is Gideon, let Baal plead. Let him plead for himself, because nobody else is going to do it for him now Gideon's around. You see what the name means? Right, Judges chapter 6 then, verse 25. Let's start to briefly have a look at the man. And it came to pass, chapter 6, verse 25, it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old. Why not the first? It's not just him being willfully, deliberately ignorant in Gideon, because the Lord has told him, I expect you to take the second. Why? Because his father, even though he was originally a worshipper of the true God of Israel, had become a worshipper of Baal. And I suggest to you that his father had either offered up or was preparing for a sacrifice toward Baal, the firstborn of the herd or the flock. And God says, I don't want your second best. That's second best now. I want the best, which is the next one. That's why God is asking for the second. And throw down the altar of Baal that thy father hath, and cut down the grove that is by it, and build an altar unto the Lord thy God upon the top of this rock in the ordered place, and take the second bullock, and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which thou shalt cut down, which thou shalt hew down. Playing on words again. His father was Joash, and the name Joash means Yahweh supports, or the God of Israel supports. His father's name is Yahweh Supports, and yet he's putting away Yahweh and worshipping Baal. So the first job, as I said before, that Gideon has done is go to your father's house and cut down his sacrifices, his images, his groves. I wonder, brothers and sisters, if he was a rich man. Verse 27 of Judges 6. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said unto him. He had 10 men, he had, a lot of servants. So he took 10 men of his servants. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, they could not do it by day, that he did it by night. I don't think that shows a lack of faith, brothers and sisters, and I've heard people say that. I think that shows him tremendous courage. God didn't say, I expect you to do it at midday. Because if God had asked him or told him to do it at midday, you get the impression he would have done it at midday. He was fearful of his father's house and the servants or whatever, and everything that came with it. God said, cut it down. So he cuts it down, but he chooses to do it by night. But he had 10 servants. Back to verse 15. Is this a contradictory verse of me suggesting maybe he was a wealthy man? And he, Gideon, said unto him, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least of my father's house. Is that contradicting what I've just said? No. Because the original doesn't mean poor as in lack of wealth. The word poor means I'm the weakest I'm the weakest in all my house, and I've got brothers as well. Am I not the least in my father's? I've got bigger and stronger and fitter and older brothers than me. And yet God calls him. We're not. None of us are called for our intellectual brilliance or our physical presence. We're called out of weakness, have I made thee strong, purely through faith. If you're still not convinced, by the way, brothers and sisters, about whether he was a rich man, perhaps we come with me to chapter 8. Not as though it matters particularly, but he gave up. Look at your leisure, or remind yourself at your leisure about what happens here. But he ferociously goes through, as it were, the land and the peoples and gets things in order for God, doesn't he? But verse 17 of chapter 18, of chapter 8, and he beat down the tower of Penuel and slew the men of the city. Then said he unto Zeba and Zalmunna, what manner of men were they whom ye slew at Tabor? And they answered, as thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. There's something about them that appeared like you, and they seem to be like the son of a king. I don't know if you agree with me on this point, it's a small point, but you know when you see young men on the television or whatever from Eton, they don't look like the lads that went to school with me. And obviously not like the lads that Tim teaches, either. They look different, brethren and sisters. There's a certain amount of wealth that pours out of their ruddy cheeks and perfect complexions, which not many teenagers have. They stand out, brothers and sisters, and I've come across it in my work. Before even somebody opens their mouth, you sometimes know something about them, don't you? Not just by the wealth of the cloth or whatever. But there was something about these men whom they had slew that they said, the people we killed were like you. They resembled the children of a king. Still not convinced? Well, one of the sons, of the 70 sons that Gideon had, was the son of a concubine. And what does he call him? I've forgotten. What does he call him? Abimelech, that's it. Yeah, that wasn't a rhetorical question. I could have done with the answer then. He called him Abimelech. What does Abimelech mean? It means son of a king. Now that's quite ironic and beautiful, really, when you think about it. Of all the 70 sons that Gideon has, he chooses to call one the son of a king. And he's the son who was the son of the concubine. It's almost suggesting to me that Gideon realises what he shouldn't have done, but he realises the poor and difficult state that this young man is in at birth and what he would be brought up the son of a concubine, and yet he's his son. So he names him the son of a king to give him some authority. But he wasn't a king, because there was no king in Israel at that time. But there were people like Gideon and Joash, people who were the leaders of the nation, who stood out. And it seems to me that he was one of those types of people, that type of man and that type of family. My father is a king, rather, is what Abimelech means, Abimelech. So, come back with me then to chapter 6, verse 11. Let's have a look at him again from another perspective. This mighty man. Verse 11. And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak which was in Ophrah, that pertained unto Joash, Yahweh supports, the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. He threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. He still carried on doing it. He didn't say, oh, let's just pack in. No, we wouldn't do that, would we, brothers and sisters? You know, oh, it's not like it was in the olden days. Oh, let's forget about it. I can tell by the embarrassed laughter that that's not happened to you. It happens everywhere. But Gideon carried on. He was a deliberate, determined man. He continued to thresh wheat, but he did it to hide it from the Midianites. Verse 12, and the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said unto him, the Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valour. Now, I don't think that phrase, mighty man of valour, means the Lord is with you, you mighty man of war. I don't think that's what God values. What does God value? God values faith and courage of having faith in him and still ploughing on, doing what he has asked you to do despite the difficulties. You're a strong man, you're a man of valour, because you will do what I ask you to do. What was the objective of all of the battles and the fighting and the murdering that Gideon brought forth? He wanted peace. We know because he says so. That's what a type of a man of valour he was. He had valour for the Lord. Verse 13, and Gideon said unto him, O my Lord, if the Lord be with us, why then is this befallen us? It's a reasonable question to ask, I suggest, brothers and sisters. And where be all his miracles which our fathers told us, saying, did not the Lord bring us up out from Egypt? But now the Lord hath forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. Yes, he had. That's exactly, it wasn't a statement of weakness. God had delivered them into the hand of the Midianites. We have to remember that. God had deliberately, purposely brought the Midianites up to make them look at themselves. And the Lord looked upon him and said, go in this thy might. Go in your strength. What was his strength? His strength was his faith. And thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee? And he says, well, I'm one of the weakest in my family. You know, why would you send me? Bit of a difference here, though, with the likes of, for example, Moses, who constant, I'm not the right man for the job. Not with Gideon. He accepts it. Oh, yeah, but he sought a sign, didn't he? Yeah, he did. He asked for a sign, which was, I want proof that you are speaking of God. And he gets a sign. The fleece one way, and the fleece the other, and the other things. And then he goes and does it. It's a statement of faith. He asked for, you know, he asked for a sign, and he got it. So, let's look at his attitude then. Verse 16. And the Lord said unto him, surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man. And he said unto him, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then show me a sign that thou talkest with me. Depart not hence, I pray thee, until I come unto thee, and bring forth my present, and set it before thee. And he said, I will tarry until thou come again. Bring that which I expect of you, but before you do, there's something I want to do. That's what Gideon's saying. I want to worship the Lord. I want to prepare. I want to get my heart right, my mind right, my soul right. Before you tell me what I've got to do, I want to bring a sacrifice. Verse 19. Gideon went in and made a ready a kid, the burnt offering, and unleavened cakes, the meal offering, of an ephah of flour. And the flesh he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and brought it out unto him under the oak, and presented it. For 40 years they've been mightily oppressed by the Midianites. They have fallen away from God. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And here is Gideon, who is not a priest, making sure he, before he even fulfills that which is asked of him, God, to give a burnt sacrifice and a peace offering, and no doubt all of the others, a meal offering and whatever. He was a man of faith. Verse 21, and the angel of the Lord put forth the end of the staff that was in his hand, and touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and there rose up fire out of the rock, and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. And when Gideon perceived that he was an angel of the Lord, I have some confusion with this. Did he not get it? When he perceived that he was an angel of the Lord, Gideon said, alas, O Lord God, for because I have seen an angel of the Lord face to face, I'm going to die, surely. And the Lord says unto him, verse 23, peace be unto thee, fear not, thou shalt not die. When Jews meet, the first thing they say is shalom, shalom, peace, peace. When this angel of the Lord met him, the first thing he said was, the Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valour. And now he's speaking, as it were, to the Lord, and the Lord says, peace be unto thee, fear not, thou shalt not die. So then Gideon builds this altar. And Gideon built an altar there unto the Lord and called it Jehovah Shalom. He's just been asked to fight for God. He's just been asked to kill the prophets of Baal and to kill the enemies of the Lord. And what's the first thing that's in his mind? He built an altar and calls it, the Lord shall send peace. Yahweh shall send peace. Jehovah or Yahweh Shalom. Let it be peace. That's why he was a man of God. Because ultimately he wanted peace. Ultimately we want peace. But as one famous historian once said, or was it an American politician, if a nation wants peace, prepare for war. We are at battle, brothers and sisters. If we want peace, we have to prepare for war. The battle of the flesh with the spirit. That's why when Jesus went into the garden, he says, watch with me 1 hour. Don't just watch with me and see if anybody comes to arrest me. Watch me, because I am in battle. I am fighting the flesh, but the Spirit will overcome. He did his Father's will. So the Lord would bring peace, and he's known for that, brothers and sisters, and he's known for his faith. Verse 28. And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was cast down, and the grove of it was cut down. It was hewn, it was Gideon that was by it, and the second bullock was offered upon the altar that was built. And they said one to another, who hath done this thing? You can imagine the hatred or the anger in, who hath done this thing? And when they inquired and asked, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, hath done it. Who else could have done it? Who else has got sufficient faith in their God to cut down the images of Ashtaroth? Some of you don't work anymore, but I do, but I don't work in a big office. Imagine if I went into the office and cut down anything and burnt anything that had representative of man's gods of today. But they didn't know who'd done it. I'd like to think that if anybody said, who's done that? Well, I bet it was that Darren, you know what he's like. I bet they wouldn't know who'd done it, brothers and sisters. I'm not suggesting those of you who live at Westroyd House, you know, you go and cut the television in pieces or whatever it is that you've got in the living room. But you know what I'm saying. Who hath done this thing? Well, it must have been Gideon, wasn't it? What a statement of faith. It's a bit like the brother in our meeting who so many, you'll know what I'm talking about, but I don't need to mention him by name. So many places they go all around the country and they say, there's a brother I know from up north. He's a lovely, lovely man. Oh yeah, you mean, I always get it right. I always know who they're talking about, and you probably know who I'm talking about. It shines out, doesn't it, brothers and sisters, when there's a man like Gideon. Bring out thy son, they say unto him, to Joash, that he may die, verse 30, because he hath cast down the altar of Baal, and because he hath cut down the grove that was by it. And Joash said unto all that stood against him, this was Joash, who had turned away from Yahweh, or he was like those in the days of Elijah. If Baal be God, then follow him. If the Lord be God, then follow him. You can't have a foot in both camps. Maybe he had a foot in both camps, or maybe he'd just gone after Baal. But this man who had gone to Baal, Joash says, will ye plead for Baal? Will ye save him? He that will plead for him, let him be put to death. Now his faith is now shining forth because of the work of his son. I don't know whether this has ever happened to you, but I've spotted it in brethren and sisters who, all right, have been faithful and they plod on through life and they're faithful, and suddenly their son or their daughter, maybe even 12 or 13, shows supreme faith, and it changes the adults. This is what happened to Joash. Because of the work of his son, everybody benefited. Because they wanted to know more about the Lord. He that will plead for him, let him be put to death whilst it is yet morning. If he be a god, let him plead for himself, because one hath cast down his altar. Therefore on that day he, Joash, called him Jerubbaal, that is, hew down Gideon, and Jerubbaal, let Baal plead, saying, let Baal plead against him, because he hath thrown down his altar. So he's known now for his actions, and he's known for his faith, and his faith converts his father. Now then, brothers, what time did I start? I have no idea. As long as you haven't any idea, it doesn't matter, does it? But right, okay. You know, the funny thing is about Christadelphians is, you know, talks mustn't be more than 35, 40 minutes, or whatever you think the rule should be. I was asked to give a talk in the NHS on investment and pensions. Please, can you make it last 2 hours? Yeah, sure, fine. And it did. Nobody complained. But if you go up past that time, whenever it's supposed to finish, whew, do you know how you are? But you're not like that, either, sisters. Because you're here as the household of God, and you love to listen to the word of God. I say anything that I'm saying to you tonight in ignorance, because I don't know you. Not like that. I wonder what Gideon would have done. Anyway, let's read on. So his name is not so much changed, but he's given this title, Jerubbaal. Now, the next thing is, verse 34, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. I don't know if math is one of your strong points, I'll pick on this Timothy up here in a minute, but there were 32,000 of the men on Gideon's side, and there were 135,000 Midianites. Now that seems like a pretty miserable chance of winning, doesn't it? You're representing 35,000 men against 135,000 men who have oppressed you for all that time. Never mind the difference in numbers, which is just over 4-1. I won't test you. You never test a teacher, they always get it wrong. I know, I advise them. He's got a calculator, he's been getting his calculator out. You see, yeah, the brethren of today aren't like they used to be, are they? I don't know, you just can't rely on them at all. But you would think that a proportion of 35,000 men on your side against 135,000, you'd think, well, that's pretty unfair. How would God expect it? And God says, no. You can't have 35,000 against 32,000 against 135,000. That's unfair on 135,000. I'm not having that. If you 32,000 fight against 135,000 and then you win, people will say you did it because of your own strength. Oh, I can't have that, says God. Forgive me putting words in God's mouth. I want to show people that I'm the Almighty One. I'm the creator of heaven and earth. I am He who will be, who I am and I will be. I am Yahweh. I will manifest myself however I choose. Can't have 32,000 against them. That's unfair on the Midianites. It's unfair on me. So let's reduce the numbers. Verse 1 of chapter 7. Then Jerubbaal, who was Gideon, and all the people that were with him, rose up early and pitched beside the well of Harod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them, by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. We can't have that, says God. You'll say you've done it, and aren't you great? Just as we did in 1967. Aren't we great? We're outnumbered massively. But look out, isn't Israel strong and intelligent and wise? Where was God in their victory, brothers and sisters? I don't remember it. I was 2.5. Or 3, or whatever it was. I know I don't look as though I'm that old, but I was, honestly. Where's the glory of God? We can't have that, says God. Now therefore, verse 3, go to, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, I don't know why you'd be fearful and afraid against only 135,000 men, but whoever's fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. And the returned of the people, 22,000, and the remained 10,000. So, of the 32,000, just over 2/3 of them say, I can't have that, can't cope with that. So now there's 10,000. Now, what's the ratio of 10,000 to 135,000? I did this on a calculator. I think it's 1 to 13.5. Do you follow? Sorry, you might not have done maths in your day. 10,000 to 135,000. Just checking your weight. 1 against 13.5. That's. Oof. God says, no. I can't have that. That's not fair. It's not fair on the Midianites. That 1 against 13.5. People will still think it's their own power. We've got to reduce the numbers. So then we have the incident, don't we, brothers and sisters, of those who went up to... Now, I don't know for fact what the... You know, the thing about the lapping up the water and whatever. Let's have a quick look at it. Verse 5. Or verse 4. The Lord said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many. Bring them down unto the water, and I will try them for thee there. I'm going to test them. Something I want to see in them. I wonder what it was. And it shall be that of whom I say unto thee, this shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee. And of whosoever I say unto thee, this shall not go with thee, the same shall not go. So he brought down the people unto the water. And the Lord said unto Gideon, every one that lappeth of the water with his tongue, as a dog lappeth, him shalt thou set by himself. Likewise, every one that boweth down upon his knees to drink. So anybody who has a drink by bending down and shoving their mouth in the water and drinking it like a dog, put them on one side, and anybody who gets down on his knees and scoops up the water like I probably would, put them on one side. Verse 6. And the number of them that lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. So therefore, there were 9,700 who did it the other way. Which would God want? Well, but all the rest of the people bowed down upon their knees to drink. It's been suggested to me. I mean, we can't prove this. maybe getting down on their knees. It was an act of almost worshipping Baal in the way that the Baal worshippers used to get down on their knees and bend. Maybe it's saying something else as well, brothers and sisters. Maybe the ones who bent over and lapped like a dog lappeth kept their other hand on their sword and were ready and waiting for the battle, irrespective. I don't know. Now then, the numbers come down to 300 against 135,000. Seems a fair ratio to me. Timothy, are you ahead of me? What is the ratio of 300 against 135,000?
That's 450 to
1, Aaron. Ah, well done. Well done. I could tell by the blush he did that on the calculator. 450 to 1. Does that ring any bells? How many prophets of Baal were there when Elijah went... Ah, 450. I wonder, I mean, Gideon's not given the numbers of the... I wonder whether Gideon was any good at maths and worked out that. I don't know. Remember what I did in the days of Elijah? I am the God of the whole earth. Anyway, let's move on. There's 300 now. So they come to battle. And I'm wary of time, but they come to battle and... Gideon, I was about to say Moses then, that's why I was pausing. Gideon, we have this, the image, this, don't we, this dream from verse 13 onwards of the man and the barley loaf and whatever. It's obviously Gideon that's the power. Gideon rolls into the tent and everything collapses around him. Gideon is the man of God, it must be a sign. And then he gives them a sign about this battle and how we should continue. Chapter 7, verse 16. And he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet in every man's hand with empty pitchers. Empty pitchers. I'm not sure if my image of this is right in my own mind, but I imagine empty pottery. Empty vessels that you would carry drink in, water or wine, whatever it might be, but empty. So you can smash them. Basically what happens is this. The men are... divided. You've got 300, so you can't just battle against 300 men against 135. What we'll do as an act of faith, just to make it even more difficult, we'll take 100 men away from the other 200, and that next 100 away from the other 200. We'll divide them into three now. So we've now got 100, 100, 100. And it's in the dark of night. And when I shout the sword of the Lord and of Gideon, you're going to smash them pitchers. 300 pitchers smashing all at the same time, and all the army of the Midianites are asleep or lolling about tired in the middle of the night. You imagine the din, brothers and sisters. And in the confusion, what happens? The Midianites destroy one another because they quickly get the sword, see somebody coming towards them, kill him. And have you ever read Ezekiel 38? The battles of Gog, who will battle against themselves, and every man shall kill of his own neighbour. It's a sign of the end, brothers and sisters. We might wonder about the number of the elect, and how are they going to sort out the world in a battle like that? But there's not that many of the Lord's elect, surely. The Lord doesn't need his elect to sort it out. He will turn every man against his own neighbour. Anyway, we move on. Come with me to Psalm 83, and then we'll go back to that. There's just a verse. I love Psalm 83 because I was saying about prophecy before at the beginning. Psalm 83 is, I believe, it's a historical psalm, but it's prophetic of the time of the end as well, and it refers back to all sorts of incidents looking forward to the future, including the days of Gideon. I'll read it all through, I think, quickly. Keep not thou silence, O God. Hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies. That's the point. They're not just enemies of Israel. They are enemies of Yahweh. They are enemies of the God of Israel. They want that name utterly destroying from the face of the earth. As the youngish man who wanted to be a Liberal Democrat MP for Huddersfield, his first name was Mohammed, and he didn't get the post, but he said to me, enough is enough, Darren. We will drive them into the sea when talking about the Jews. Lo, thine enemies make a tumult. They that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people and consulted against thy hidden ones. It's not just a history lesson, is it? It's a prophecy. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel be no more in remembrance. That's precisely what the Midianites wanted to do. That's precisely what Agag wanted to do. That's precisely what certain peoples now want to do, isn't it? For they have consulted together with one consent. I don't know if you know much about Arab Muslim terrorist politics, but Hamas and Hezbollah absolutely hate one another because they are opposite ends of the spectrum of Islam. And yet, before his death, Osama bin Laden said that Hamas and Hezbollah must stand together for only one cause: the annihilation of Israel. They have consulted together with one consent. Even enemies have come together with one consent. They are confederate against thee. The tabernacles of Edom, whom Agag was, the Ishmaelites of Moab and the Hagarenes, Gebal and Ammon, Amalek, the Philistines and the inhabitants of Tyre, that's, you could say, the Palestinians through Hamas and the Lebanese through Hezbollah, those terrorist organizations. Asser or Iraq is also joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. Do unto them as unto Midianites. Yeah? The numbers might have been small on the side of the Israelites, but do unto them as unto the Midianites. Get them destroyed, and they will destroy one another. As to Sisera, as to Jabin, as to the brook Kishon, the previous incident in the book of Judges, when Sisera and his armies, the 900 chariots of iron, who mightily pressed Israel, were utterly destroyed, ultimately Sisera, which perished at Endor. They became as dung for the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb, the wolf and the raven, the enemies of Israel, and that's there in the book of, when we read about Gideon. Yea, all their princes of Zebra and Zalmunna, which are there in the days of Gideon, who said, let us take to ourselves the houses of God to possession. There, let's take a spoil. That should ring some bells. Let's take a spoil of everything that they have. That's what they're going to say, isn't it, brothers and sisters? And they see the wealth of Israel. Oh my God, make them like a wheel, as the stubble before the wind, as the fire burneth the wood, and as the flame setteth the mountains on fire. So persecute them with thy tempest, and make them afraid with thy storm. Fill their faces with shame, that they may seek thy name, O Lord. Let them be confounded, or blush and troubled for ever. Yea, let them be put to shame and perish, that men may know that thou, whose name alone is Jehovah, or Yahweh, art the Most High over all the earth. Is that not the kingdom? But to get to the kingdom, there's got to be difficulty, and there's got to be battles. As we all fight with the flesh, so God's enemies will fight ultimately with Israel. But ultimately, all men will know that Jehovah or Yahweh is the Most High God. Back to Judges then, if you will. Just a small little point, and I'll finish as soon as I can. But chapter 8, I want to just show something. This man of valour, mighty man of valor. Look at his humility and his diplomacy with his own people. Gideon did not use all of the tribes of Israel to fight. He only used 300 men. But there were some of the tribes of Israel who were desperate to fight because they liked the glory of fighting. And it caused him a problem. Chapter 8, verse 1. And the men of Ephraim said unto him, why hast thou served us thus, that thou callest us not when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites? And they did chide with him, shouting, why didn't you call us to battle? We wanted to be part of that. And he said unto them, listen to this diplomacy, brothers, it's beautiful. What have I done in comparison of you? What have we done? You're good men of Ephraim. You've fought many a times. Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Gideon was an Abiezrite. You've done lots more than we have. We've only done a little bit. We did, you know. He praises them. God hath delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. Those were listed in Psalm 83. And what was I able to do in comparison of you? Then their anger was abated toward him when he had said that. A soft answer turneth away wrath. What a good man. What a lovely man. He was ruthless, brothers and sisters. We better move on. He was absolutely ruthless, though, for God's will. Chapter 8, verse 32. Let's have a look at his death. It's a statement. Well, verse 29 of chapter 8, "And Jerubbaal the son of Joash went and dwelt in his own house, and Gideon had 70 sons." It's the same man. I don't know what it's saying here, but Gideon is Jerubbaal. Jerubbaal is Gideon. "Jerubbaal the son of Joash went and dwelt in his own house, and Gideon had 70 sons of his body begotten, for he had many wives." And he dies. Doesn't add up, does it, brother and sister? This man that's listed in Hebrews 11 as a tremendous man of faith, who is obviously going to be part of the kingdom, he has 70 sons and many wives and a son of a concubine. Brothers and sisters, we don't get a place in the kingdom according to our behaviour, do we? We don't get a place in the kingdom according to what we've done. A plus B does not equal C. There is no mathematics that makes us worthy of a place in the kingdom. There was no mathematics that made Gideon worthy of a place in the kingdom. It was the grace of God. Isn't it lovely? So, verse 22 of this chapter. This is a powerful statement, really. "Then the men of Israel spoke unto Gideon and said, Rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." Isn't that beautiful? This man of faith. No wonder he's listed in Hebrews 11. I'm not bothered about any of that. I only did it because God asked me to do it. Let God rule after you. The end of the chapter. "When Gideon was dead," verse 30, it came to pass as soon as Gideon was dead that the children of Israel turned again and went a whoring after Baalim and made Baal Beareth their god." As soon as this man, this mighty man of valour, not because he was a strong man, this mighty man of faith was dead, they drifted off back. "And the children of Israel remembered not the Lord their God, who had delivered them out of the hands of all their enemies on every side. Neither showed they kindness to the house of Jerubbaal," namely Gideon, "according to all the goodness which he had showed unto Israel." He loved his people. And he showed his love for his people most by his love for the Father. The God of glory, brothers and sisters, did all of this. Not Gideon. Lesson for us, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Let us hew down the images in our own lives, the false gods. Do our best in our own small way. And remember, it is God that raiseth up. And it is God that by grace gives a place in the kingdom. Thank you.